Okay, that's all right.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Allie Smith. Hello, Toby Miller.
Hello, Ali. It's so nice to meet you. And I'm thinking that we must have almost been in some of the same alleys, pardon the stupid pun, together many, many years ago without having ever met. But it's wonderful to have you here. It's wonderful to make your acquaintance, and especially with the backdrop, which looks like it could be a dark room, or it could be a set of theater lights, show
Well,
lights.
Toby, I know it presents as though I'm on a stage right now, and that is as it should be. But the truth is, I have a very limited space to work in right now, so I've created a tableau, if you will, for you. And let's leave it at
Oh, well, I feel privileged. Thank you. And I wanted to kick things off by asking you what's currently preoccupying you, interesting you, dynamizing you?
Well, that's a really interesting question because I've just had a huge life change where I grew up and lived in New York City my entire life until last year when I restarted in the UK, which is where my husband's from. So, what's dynamizing me these days is possibility in this way that I've had my head cracked open. I knew how to work New York. I knew how to, work the systems, exist below certain radars. And also, I've been doing things in similar ways for decades. So now I'm here. Most of my work has disappeared. I'm living in my father-in-law's house. I can't afford a house yet, or I can't figure out how to get a house yet. So everything is simultaneously frightening and full of endless potential, which is something I haven't really felt in decades. So it's an exciting but challenging time.
Wonderful. Can I ask what parts of London you're hanging out in? This is not to ask where your father-in-law lives, but just in general.
I actually live in Norwich, which
Oh,
I
okay.
love.
All right.
Yeah, and I take the it's a hop, skip, and a jump on the train down to London, swing in London town. I walk around by myself. I do a little of this, a little of that. I love it because when I grew up, London was like pretty symbolic in a way that I know New York is for many people over here. And the fact that I'm here swinging around, and then I get on the train and hop, skip, and jump back is so exciting to me still. So.
And actually, Norwich, which I've only been to a couple of times, is a fantastic place. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
it is it's amazingly beautiful, and you're near the water and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
So.
but there's a real art scene here too, and a real LGBTQ plus scene and underground music scene. People keep telling me I should be bored, but I'm not.
Well, University of East Anglia is where American studies as a discipline actually got going in the UK.
Oh, wow.
And not only that, but the university was really one of the few places that did creative writing. And it had, proper real authors teaching creative writing, not just a bunch of sort of not very jacked up profs. So it has an interesting history in that way too. But it's no, I agree. There's no reason to be bored there. And if you are, you can get out of there pretty quickly on, a rickety train system, which is as pitiful as Amtrak's, but you haven't got far to go.
I guess we're one of only 53, is it literary cities in globally in recognized, what is it? It's not UNESCO, what is it?
Oh, I don't know
Some
about that.
organization. Yeah, so I'm holding on to these
You're in
things.
a
We'll see.
literary city.
Literary
Who knows?
city.
Okay, wow. I'll stop telling people about creative writing programs and start saying, Norwich is a literary city.
It sounds way more pretentious. You should definitely do that.
So that's a really big life change, and it's a change for your whole family, right? I mean, for everybody. And it inevitably shifting places. As you say, can produce some creativity, but can also hold one back a bit because there's so much that's new to learn. And you stand out just from opening your mouth, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you once you speak, you are not under the radar, whether you want to be or not.
Yes, but do you know what? If you ever want to feel like you have a mellifluous voice or some sort of special presentation just move countries, I think. You know, the same way my husband has been skating on that British accent for decades. Now I'm here and people are like, your voice is so lovely. I'm like, are you? Oh, I've never heard a New York accent described. That's fine. Okay.
When I moved to New York, one of the guys that I worked with, who didn't speak to me for the first 6 weeks, came and knocked on my office door and said, Toby, I'm sorry I've never spoken to you. It's just I hate guys with voices like yours because you get all the girls. He said, yeah. But I realize that's completely unfair and really awful and welcome.
Oh, bless him. You came around.
It was really sweet. It was really he had a sideline as a forger. And he told me that my signature, which is just a scrawl, was actually harder to forge because he practiced this with all his co-worker signatures than the ones that looked sort of fancy and properly arty, whereas mine looked like basically a person who just was drawing a couple of lines as a scribble.
So anyway, what kind of stuff was he forging, though?
Checks, I think.
Oh, did that ever come from Rhode Island,
which I hadn't realized, but is sort of, as you know, is one of the gangster capitals of the United States, or as a state. So he took those skills with him wherever he went. But regardless of that, the reason I got in touch with you was because, having been a fan of yours for a long time, I found a way to connect to you, because I did, you know, I saw your piece in the Groniad. You know why it's called the Groniad, right?
Because it's always groaning.
They don't know.
Why?
It's notorious for typographical mistakes. Absolutely. So Private Eye, which is the little sort of slightly anarchistic but business style magazine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Private Eye. Yeah, my kid loves that. Yeah.
Right. So they refer to the Daily Telegraph as the Tory Graph. And they refer to the Guardian as the Groniad. And I was once invited to go onto a podcast for them, which I did, but then during the podcast, I referred to it as the Groniad, and everyone's face went like this, draws sort of clown's sad face, end of my Groniad career. But anyway, point is, I read this wonderful, wonderful piece that you did in The Guardian on called Ali Smith's 90s New York Punk Scene Photo Essay, but it's an essay with lots of words by you as well. And then I found your website. And I wondered if you could tell us about that essay, but also about your new book, The Ballad of Speedball Baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that essay came directly out of the work I've been doing for my memoir, which is about being in an underground influential punk band in New York in the 90s. Being the only woman in that band, and as I like to say, surviving the slings and arrows that society reserves for women who refuse to comply. So it's about that era, and it's about walking through that world as a woman, being signed to a major label deal at a time where every major label is trying to find the next Nirvana, the ways in which that, of course, explodes, implodes, and the madness of being in a band. So it's funny now. So that the book, the memoir, The Ballad of Speedball Baby, includes a lot of photos from the times that I took. And I've always been taking photos and writing in journals and observing. And it's funny to create work at the time that you think you can't imagine it has a place in the world, because you can't predict what place it will find. And now this 90s work is sort of emblematic of a time. And, you know, I guess I'm museum years old now. Like I'm at a point where, you know, people are looking back, people are making, putting my friend's shirts in the punk rock museum in Las Vegas. And John Varvatos has taken over the shell of CBGB's and put plastic sheets over my friend's band stickers on the wall for people to gawk at. And, you know, it's an interesting set of feelings that comes with that. But it's exciting, too, because it does give purpose to all these photos that have been around forever. And many of these people went on to have bigger careers, or it's just emblematic of a really gritty time and place in New York that spawned a lot of cultural, culturally significant bands and art. So,
you mentioned being the only woman in the band. As far as you know, Did the other members have these other interests, like photography and keeping a diary and writing and so on? Or was it sort of sex and drugs and rock and roll and no other art forms?
Right. Well, our singer, who is notoriously jangly and unnerving and angular, it was really well read and steeped in literature and poetry, and that combined with his own predilections, his drug seductions, made for his certain brand of his view of the world. The guitarist, Matt Verderay, was influenced by all sorts of things, including art films like Zentropa, and he had grown up in the Middle East for a certain amount of time, and the call to prayer resonated with him as a sort of very beautiful sonic memory. So he took inspiration from everywhere, and he had silkscreened for Andy Warhol. So he was also privy to that world, and he was bringing all sorts of different angles into the art
Yes.
we were making. I would say Martin Owens, who's the drummer, who's British, was the most straightforward, great drummer, hilarious. Can I curse on this podcast? Are we cursing today? Okay, fucking hilarious. Had the accent, gorgeous, smoking one-liners all the time. So we also had our little,
You
our
had your
sort of
niche, but what I
niche.
guess what you're helping me with is getting away from the stereotype, which would be that people that did one thing. You had one dude who was the stereotype, right? The British drummer, in terms of it's all rock straight ahead. But the rest of you had other interests. It may have informed what you did musically or been informed by it, but that wasn't the totality of you guys.
Sure,
Right?
absolutely. You're 100% right. And I would hesitate to reduce Martin to total stereotype because he wasn't a douchebag, too. He was like a lovely, charming guy. And everybody in my band, even though I'm talking about misogyny and the misogyny of the music world, and we're all brainwashed to a certain extent, and we have to undo that, was heavily steeped in all the reasons that, even back then, the reasons that the patriarchy needed smashing. They were all like trustworthy to a big extent. There were certain divides, but they were good allies.
That's another thing it helps to do away with some stereotypes, I think, in terms of the undoubted sexism, the undoubted misogyny of so much of the music world, be that so-called popular music or so-called classical music or written music, as people now like to refer to it. So I really appreciate that. When you went back to write a memoir, did you rely on things you'd written at the time or your memory or calling people up and saying, did you say that? Did I do this? What happened that night or whatever?
Yes, and yes.
Oh,
I started the way you would like, and then this happened, and that. You just sort of like blurt, and then you're like, oh, it's not a diary. Okay, stop. You just want everybody to know the most exciting parts, the most dramatic parts, blah blah blah. And then I really thought about like, oh, credibility, and I went back and looked at the journals, and it turned out I hadn't been making it up, which was hugely exciting. And it was really
ha.
like lots of things were confirmed. Some things had to be tweaked. Your experience of something is so highly subjective, and this is still my, as I acknowledge at the end, my highly subjective version. But I did check in with everybody. I didn't go so far as to say, "Is it okay with you if I put this in?" I mean, sometimes I did with sensitive stuff. I just said, "I want to know how you're feeling about this. Did this happen? Is this credible?" And and to a person, there wasn't anybody that suggested I keep something embarrassing out, and some of it is really, exposing of people. So I was touched by that. My singer Ron, there's some very volatile, frightening, potentially embarrassing scenarios that I write about. But in context, they're just about a journey through this life. And I think what I'm feeling now is none of us should be ashamed about anything that has happened to us, particularly that might have been bad or embarrassing or this or that, or that we were flawed human beings. So to his credit, he was like, yeah, I probably felt a little differently about that, but I get it. And that is what happened. And that's your version. So yeah, it turned out to be quite credible. And it was very helpful to have the journals and photography because I had tons of photos. So I could literally look and be like, oh, that person was there and this and that. It was a big puzzle to construct.
And I should say that your website, which I'll link to in the notes to our chat, has is fantastic, as you would
Thank you.
expect from a photographer. And it has a number of links to reviews. I'm guessing there aren't many books have been reviewed in the Norwich Evening News and the Village Voice. In fact, Ali, until I went to your website, I didn't know the Voice still existed.
You're welcome.
Thank you, but like everybody, I was a regular reader when I lived in the
Yeah.
village. But I thought it had utterly disappeared, but maybe you've inspired its revival.
No, I think they disappeared for a while and then they came back and they're trying to figure out how to exist in this new landscape because they were the go-to, right? That's where you got your job, your date, and your apartment on the back cover of the Village Voice.
And also interesting debates because at one point I remember it had a huge array of sex ads, which would be for performers, sex workers, and so on. And the debate within the Voice and amongst readers about carrying that advertising. There was a, in addition to those famous rock and jazz writers, right, like Bob Chriscor and Nat Hentoff, it also had, very lively debates about gender and race and all sorts of things, as well as you say, saying this is what's happening this week in this place, and what was on at the Film Forum. I mean, everything, from CBGBs to the Film Forum, really, it had a lot. And these very lively controversies. I'm sure Norwich Evening News is the same.
I'm not getting that flavor that it is, but all right. I feel like if I can still dip a toe in the Village Voice, I can handle not being in New York. I still have my tethers to the life,
Oh
do
my
you know?
God, are you kidding? And for old men like me, they were in the Grawny ad, so that's all you need. This is not your only book. I wonder if you could perhaps take us a little bit into this one, then talk about the others a bit, and then we could focus on your photography. Would that be all right as a way of
Of
proceeding?
course.
Yeah,
Yeah,
lovely.
of
So
course.
tell us a bit about this one, a bit more detail, and the things that you've already said in a way it's quite revelatory and perhaps a little painful in terms of descriptions of some people, but you see it as the best kind of truth that you could get at and record.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a new, I think this, The Ballad of Speedball Baby as a music memoir stands out in the sense that, in many senses, but in that people say it's written more novelistically, it's written more like a narrative. And it's, one of a handful of female voices representing that time. So if you're going to write your music history, you need to include more voices, more varied voices, and that's starting to happen. But also, when I was trying to get a book deal for it, the responses from the big five publishers were essentially like, she's not famous, who cares? And that was a really discouraging, I love the writing. Somebody actually said, I love the writing, fantastic. She's not famous, she's nobody. And that one really stuck with me. And I was like, wow. Okay, so according to music history, there are five women that did anything: Debbie Harry, Chrissie Hynde, Patti Smith. There's a very small cluster. They're wonderful, all of them. They all influenced me. But what about the tens of thousands of others of us who were living the life, making art, sometimes in the face of great pressure and adversity, navigating all sorts of sexism in every aspect of our subculture? It just was so discouraging and unimaginative to hear that that lived experience was basically worthless because once you're in pop culture of music, it's supposed to be like, well, did they make it? And that's not most people's experience of making art or living a creative life, which I'm proud to say at this point, I've lived as a creative in whatever form that means, music, photography, writing, strawberry picking, working at a, in a hospital cafeteria, whatever. I've lived the life that I have created as my creation for most of my life. So I think that's a worthwhile story. And what I do think is unusual is that, I was really committed to, telling it with vulnerability and not a story of like, look how cool I am. I did this and then I did this and then I went to rehab and then I got out of rehab and the end, So maybe I had the joy of not being like one of the top celebrity female artists who's supposed to present in that way. You know, I got to be a messy, nuanced person like all of us. And that was my commitment. If I'm going to do anything with this of worth, I'm going to talk about sexual assault, which I can't even tell you how many, almost to a woman, of people I know have experienced some version. Why do we live silently? Why do we, you know, absorb shame in that? I don't want to act like the whole thing is heavy. There's plenty of laughs and ridiculousness, but I like to think that I really did double down on being honest and vulnerable in it. So that was this book, and it's the first long form narrative that I've written. You know, before that, I put out two books, Laws of the Bandit Queens and Mama Love, How the Mother Half Lives, and they were both Bandit Queens was women I admired through, you know, had forged careers while being off the beaten path. I wanted to know you could do that. So like Sandra Bernhard, Lydia Lunch, Alice Walker, fantastic women that had done unusual things and succeeded. And then the next one was about motherhood through a feminist perspective. So again, it's just about let women, let people, and let women particularly be fully realized, three-dimensional, nuanced, messy, flawed, instead of this Madonna whore nonsense that we all live with. And yeah, those were photo-driven. Gloria Steinem wrote the back cover copy for Mama Love, which was a huge, big feeling for me. And it won two book awards. And those are photo-driven with writing. This is the first one that's leading with writing. So.
So, yes, and you've also got, endorsements for a number of incredible hipsters for
Yeah.
the latest book.
Kate
Now,
Pearson, Nick Zinner, Kid Congo, all the big dudes.
X, B-52s, they're all there, dude. And I think one of the richnesses here is this interlacing of photography and words, which is in that Grawniad piece that I mentioned, where you use the expression off kilter, unfiltered, and out of focus to describe life in the 1990s in Gotham. I wondered if you could talk to us about your photography aesthetic in terms of things being out of focus as a metaphor or as a practical description.
Yeah, I mean, I think I worked backwards on that one. I looked at the photos and I was like, God, I used to, I led with a lot of heart, let's just say. I had like, I didn't always have great equipment. I had a lot of heart and energy. Often everything was underexposed, overexposed. One time I poured a beer in my camera. So I'm just saying that I was approaching it with the same energy that I was approaching everything. I was approaching music, like immediacy, let's make something happen. Blah. And sometimes that worked, you know, and I wouldn't trade it in. I mean, it's frustrating when you're not very technically minded or precise. You don't have expensive equipment, but you know, we've seen all this good stuff that comes out of that in music and art, right? Like just do it, just get on with it, do the work. I'm very sort of like, what's that?
The punk ethos.
The entire punk ethos, exactly. I feel like I took the punk ethos to photography. And I mean, I ended up studying photography too, but I never quite let go of that. And I think I've also brought the punk ethos to writing. That sort of valuing, you know, the inherent value of creation, just do it. And it's also sort of like a union mentality, like, well, I got writing in my tool belt, you know, and I got a camera in my tool belt. Like, I just feel like they're all sort of like practical ways to get to talk about the human condition. You know what I mean? Like, I've got a base. It took me around the world. You know, so they all have that same energy and intent, which is like boldness. You know, photography took me into all sorts of scenarios, some I shouldn't have been in. The desire to connect, putting that over the sort of fussy, meticulous nature that of technical aspects of things.
That said, can I ask you a question about equipment and technique and so
You can ask. Yeah.
Well, you said that having done all this photography, you then studied it formally. And my question is, Did that study in terms of technique and did developments in technology through to the digital help your art change your art?
The doing has helped and changed my art. The doing, the incessant doing. I think I could have gotten, quote unquote, better faster if I had listened more, but I wasn't a great listener when I was young. I liked to just do it. If I had been more humble and let people teach me things, I could have probably learned about technique and lighting, proper lighting. I still stumble through, like, how do you light a headshot? A headshot, that's like lighting. So there's that sort of aspect of it. People complain about digital cameras. For me, I saw the benefits it gave me of that immediate feedback, and I did learn on the job in that way. If something's not working, how to adjust, over time I got tired of not knowing how to do things, so I really did sort of just figure it out on the job, So like all the Guardian portraits, usually you show up for a celebrity portrait and you've got maybe 5 minutes. Maybe they tell you you've got 45 minutes, but you end up with 2 minutes. You're in a space you don't know. You're trying to manage a scenario with somebody who you're supposed to make feel comfortable, but they have a hierarchy because they're famous. So there's a lot of different skills you have to bring to that. And then you've got to get a great picture. And I was getting tired of not getting a picture that was as good as my experience had been. So I started learning more about lighting.
So
But digital helped.
some of that is about portraiture, the desire for portraiture being evocative, attractive, but profound, I guess. And before it was more about instantaneity and the moment. Is
And the
that
what was about instantaneity?
the period before in your photography?
Yes, it's still about the moment, but if you have to deliver a job, you're embarrassed to hand in something that looks like crap. So it's still about eliciting a response from the subject. That's always going to be the same thing for me. People marvel. They're like, I've never seen a picture of Fran Lebowitz smiling before. I'm like, I know, I got that. Because I work hard at that aspect, which is getting something with and from people. But yeah, the technical aspect came later for sure.
And one of the things you photograph is food. I wanted to ask you about that because I don't like being in a restaurant dining with people who are taking photographs of each course. I don't know why. I shouldn't feel this way. Can you help me, Ali?
I can help you by supporting you and saying absolutely. No, that's a totally different thing. The only times I take pictures of food, it's because I'm being paid to take pictures of food and I need to work. That's it. Otherwise, I'm just eating food, so I don't really do that whole food porn thing on my own time.
But it is, I mean, taking pictures of food is super important for things like gourmet magazines, for cookbooks, for cook sites, all sorts of reasons for doing it. Why is Instagram littered with plates?
Why is it littered with anything? We're just programmed to show off, Like it, when we were coming up, this is one of those in my day. No, but it is a noticeable difference. Like it would have to me seemed so uncool to constantly show off. Like, here's what I'm doing. Here, don't I look good here? Blah 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 blah. It was like antithetical to just like you're supposed to pretend you don't really care what anybody thinks and you're just getting on with it and like you happen to look really cool. That's what you're supposed to do. And so it's just an interesting adjustment, and we can all go on about like, is it good for people? Is it bad for people? Blah, blah, blah. It's definitely a thing unto itself. It's not life. You know what I mean? We do it for various reasons.
Got it. There's a particular photo story that I wanted to ask you about, and it's we actually gossiped about it earlier. It's from, I'm just looking, September 2021, and it does have some food in it, actually.
Which one?
In one
Which
of the
one?
in one in this is how I look taking my son to school, my sanitized fingers crossed. This was an op-ed for the New York Times, and for those who are not familiar with the New York Times or the genre, op-ed means literally opposite the editorial. So it's an opinion piece, but it's not written by the newspaper. It's written by a contributor. The contributor might be Tony Blair, or it might be Ali Smith. It could be a war criminal or a punk. We're not entirely.
Which one was I just want to make sure which one I was. Okay.
Well,
Yeah.
actually, he was in a rock band.
I'm sure that was a great pen.
Yeah, right. I think he may have had ambitions to be Mick Jagger's godchild or something. Anyway,
Do you
whatever.
see what happens when artistic dreams are not supported or don't work out?
Quite so. Now, this is a very moving story. It's a great COVID-19 story, wonderfully photographed, and you told me off air by your husband. Wonderful words, wonderful images, wonderfully evocative. I wonder if you could talk us through that piece as, mom, partner, author, subject, and the kind of moment of panic, years of panic, a couple of years of panic that people went through.
Yeah, I mean, we all have our version. In New York, it's a little bit like we all have our version of where we were when the towers went down, in 9/11. And everybody in the world has their version of what happened during the pandemic. Of course, on some levels, I feel I'm one of those people that's like felt guilty that, of course, it wasn't easy. We had zero work. There were very few benefits. We were terrified, like everybody, or most people. There was no, you remember, that feeling of like, there's no cure. We don't know what this is. It is killing people. I knew several people around us had died in the pandemic, eventually, including my husband's mother, who was here in England. And so it was very edgy time. And in America, the whole mask, no mask thing had been totally politicized. We were mask people. Other people were no mask people, and they were angry with the mask people. And it was just like, what about the logic people? I would like to think we're the logic people. Vaccination, all that stuff had been so intensely politicized. So we kind of just hunkered down and, having our son with us a few years ago, he's 14 now, we just got very tight and made it a little nest for ourselves and tried to make it as loving and warm as we could. And so when it came time to re-enter society, where they said, no, you have to go back to, he'd been home for over a year doing school remotely. And he had a, I would say, besides all the fear and the excessive hand washing, which I think we're still paying for in terms of, hypervigilance, he had a good time. We made it, we made it creative. And I'll always value that time in some way, but it was time to go back. And it all happened quite abruptly, and it was still in the thick of things. And New York is such an intense place, and everybody's on top of each other, and there's just no elbow room. And there was a lot of mental illness on the street. Just people were in such dire straits, and there's no real social care in America. So it was vivid. Walking to school became quite a violent affair. It was really taxing, and I was trying to keep it out of my son's face and out of my heart as much as I could. But I'd been hit on the subway. There's so many drugs in open view, and it was just getting very ugly. And that piece came about. My husband Joshua Bright is a photographer for the New York Times. And I can't remember whether they asked him to photograph something about the pandemic and going back to school, and we proposed that we did it through my view of a mom who is now in a hot white panic about this, sending my kid back to a tiny overcrowded classroom. And so we just walked through the experience together, and I was devastated that I could no longer, I mean, it's just like parenting, right? Like there's always a time when you can no longer keep your child safe from everything. You can't hold them physically. You can't insist they do certain things. And here was the world sort of taking my baby back and putting him what I thought was a really treacherous situation. So we followed that. That was the through line, and tried again to be quite real about the feelings involved.
The other news story slash column with imagery I wanted to ask you about is your one this time in The Guardian, also from a few years back, about a gentleman with pancreatic cancer and the difficulty of getting hold of medicalized marijuana as a palliative. I wondered if you could share a little bit of that story with us.
I learned about Stephen and his husband Wade through friends who were in a support group for pancreatic cancer, and just gave me a little buzz. Somebody had mentioned he had been having a hard time getting medical marijuana to soothe his pain. It was the only thing that worked for him. And again, that's highly charged politically. Is it an evil thing or a good thing? Drugs are bad, all this stuff. But also in America, there's a shift happening where marijuana across the board is being changed state by state, in terms of legality. So I just really wanted to understand the human aspect of being a person who is dying, to whom kindness is being withheld on a sort of governmental level, and how people are used as pawns in political arguments, And so Stephen was an absolutely lovely man, as was his husband, and they allowed me in to their lives. I stayed over at night, watched the process, which was highly medicalized, watched him get worse, watched him go to this dispensary for medical marijuana, learned all about the actual nature of what he was being given, saw how much it helped him, saw how hard it was for him to get it. And I just wanted to, as usual, I think like the best way to make a point about anything is to go for the human story in it, because that's where it hurts, right? On a political level, you can argue forever, but once you see something, the ramifications of those politics and human story. So I stayed with them through Stephen's death. And he was fighting the whole way for just the right to feel a little bit better. And the reasons that that was being taken away from him were appalling to me. So I just documented, I just stayed back and watched and tried to give them a platform to talk about this very difficult situation.
There's a wonderful couple of photographs of him with boxing gloves on and various patches attached to his body. And it juxtaposes a notion of strength and vitality with a notion of illness and weakness that's, I think, very compelling.
Thanks for appreciating that one. I know it was an odd one, but he had been an avid boxer before. He had been quite large, and went down to a slip of a thing, and all those portals or whatever they're called, were the way that his husband had to administer huge amounts of medication to him constantly, every day and night. So, yeah, he was still fighting, if you will.
And one of the other things I wanted to ask you about is on your website, you've got a category for your photography of events. And a couple of the photos that are very striking are rah, 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 Second Amendment rights, supposed. This is to do, the plurality of listeners, Ali, are in the US, but the majority is not. Second Amendment rights, allegedly, to bear arms, but actually, there it, if it were properly adjudicated by people with brains, it would be understood to be the right to form a militia when there is an unrepresentative government and nothing fucking else. But you have one person saying Jesus loves guns in one photo or something to that effect, and another person saying fuck the NRA, which is the National Rifle Association, recently exposed as guess what, an entirely corrupt organization.
No, tell me that's not true.
Surely not. Surely not. And which in the 70s was a basically pretty mild-mannered Clark Kent-like organization based in Gotham that was about people interested in hunting, but moved out to the wilds and now is just an advocate for mass murder. So you can see I've got no particular pitch on this at all.
Yeah, me neither. I love that shirt. That's amazing. That's
Yeah.
great.
So tell us a little bit, if you could, about what it's like recording an event when, one, you've got a set of values in play that's offended, two, a set of values in play that's satisfied, three, you haven't really got a commitment at all. It's just a job.
Right. Well, those particular photos were extraneous to the jobs. One was the God Loves Guns was a Bernie Sanders rally that I was covering. So I could have chosen to ignore him. You know, he had nothing to do with, I mean, he's, I would have preferred to ignore him. No. So I don't know. I mean, if you're shooting purely journalistically, of course you have to bring neutrality to what you're doing, but do we ever? Is there anything that doesn't have a point of view? I'm framing it. I'm choosing what to leave out. I'm choosing the moment. You could argue that almost nothing ha doesn't have a point of view. You know, I was there at Jacob Javits at the Hillary Clinton party on election night, which quickly turned into a funeral, mass funeral. But you know, if you're looking. If you're trying to make compelling imagery, I think it's going to have a slant. It's going to have a twist. It's going to have a statement. It's going to have humor or irony, something that pulls you in. I guess you could say you're just always documenting what's in front of you. I would argue that's probably not the case. When you get into serious manipulation of images, that's when you're not really, in my mind, you know, allowed to call that journalism. But yeah, I hate the NRA. I've worked with Sandy Hook parents, you know, who lost children in the shooting. I've proposed stories about gun violence and had those published. It's definitely something I feel passionate about. That guy was a kook on any level, you know, even if you're talking about, do you like hamburgers? You're like, fuck hamburgers, you know, like, you know, he wasn't like a well-balanced representative of the NRA, if there is such a thing. So, you know, yeah, those were more my editorial eye. They're what I want to talk about. I want to revel in that woman with her cigarette saying fuck the NRA because she looks cool, and the bonkers guy with the other sign. So I don't pretend that's neutral.
Ali, I've got a couple more questions for you, and then what I'd like to do is throw it over to you for you to add anything or maybe subtract something from what we've said already. Is that okay?
Course, whatever you want to do.
So, first question is, you said you wanted to get away from the teleological notion of the unfurling story of leading the life to going to rehab to being a grown-up and so on. But one of the things that you've gone through is a transition to parenthood. And I wondered about parenthood in terms of its influence on writing and photography. We've already discussed a couple of stories that relate to that, but whether that's altered the how you write, how you depict things, etc.
Right, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think anything that makes us feel more connected to the world or more responsible to other people. Or I can't say for everybody, for me, compels me to care more about what I put into the world, you know? So for instance, I was step parenting long before I had my biological child and, you know, to a young woman. And I think that I used to shoot a lot of book covers, like tons, like hundreds of book covers, a lot of teenage novels and, you know, teen lit and stuff, lots of models. I had a lot of fun doing it because it was creative and I was making pretty images. I love building a set. I like working with a crew. I was proud to always be nice to the young women that were the models. So like I took a lot of pride in that kind of work. That said, I was retouching 16-year-old girls to look more perfect, you know? It was a different time, hopefully, where there was real no there was no notion that that might not be the case. So we were just all doing what you did for that kind of work. And that became increasingly uncomfortable to for me as my stepdaughter grew up, you know, as it should. So maybe that's one sort of distinct example of like you get, you know, you hone in of how you want to be in the world and what you want to put into the world. Maybe that's just getting older too.
No, but that's a wonderful, wonderful example. I used to, well, I left New York to live in LA, and I got to know people whose job was to touch up images on movie posters that had been constructed so that women would have smaller waists and larger breasts. That was their job. These were committed feminists, and this is what they did to fund their own art.
Well, do you know, there's that thing, right? Like it's, you know, that idea of scarcity of work and opportunity and the fear of dying poor. It's like, you know, you are constantly circling back to yourself to figure out how you're going to navigate. If you have a conscience, if you care about that, you got to keep circling back to yourself through the years and say, where am I in this equation? Weighing those things up. You know, I really like to eat. I'm grateful for my apartment, you know, like these things, but it can easily get out of control. You know, it can easily be seductive and be like, oh, you know, it's just, I remember there was this supermodel from the 80s, 70s, 80s. Anyway, she was a big deal. You know her, but I'm not going to say the name. And they hired me to retouch her bathing suit ad. And this was 20 years ago. So, you know, so 90s. So she was in her 50s or whatever. I was like, she was doing a line of bathing suits. I was like, okay, you know, just gentle retouching. They're like, oh, definitely just gentle retouching, a little tweaks here and there, blah, 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 you know, remove her mustache. They didn't say that, but I'm just saying like whatever they were going to pretend it was going to be. I was like, okay, I really needed the money. So I took on the job and I kept turning them in and kept turning them in and they kept pushing back. She ended up looking like a paper plate with a face drawn on it and a stick figure underneath, you know, and I knew I'd been doing the devil's work, but I was just like, it's that thing, that one left me with an ick, you know what I mean? So you learn for next time and you make your choices.
Well, I think for these women, this was survival, as you say. I don't think they were ever seduced by it, as it were. They thought it was revolting, but they felt they had to do it. These things. So my last question before throwing to you to, as I say, offer something that you'd like us to discuss that we have, or something we have discussed where you want to add something. My last question is to say, there has been real consistency in your life, in amongst what must have been the havoc of the scene that you occupy. There's been a lot of consistency, I think, in terms of your cultural commitments. I'm wondering where that comes from.
You mean in terms of my commitment to continuing to keep moving?
To keep
ahead?
Moving, to keep producing, to have the punk aesthetic allied to motherhood, allied to photographic technique, allied to marriage.
You know, I think we all are shaped for better and worse by where we come from, right? There were certain gifts given to me as a child by my parents. And I think the upside of this compulsion to keep working, doing the work, is that I kept doing the work. You know, the dark side being probably a compulsion to keep doing the work and overarching, you know. Or until you can figure it out, too much emphasis put on external approval, or not approval, but impressing people or whatever. So there's a mixed bag there. But like when I was young, my dad was a classical musician. He played with the Metropolitan Opera, Stokowski, and several other things, and Jacob Druckmann, his avant-garde period. But he decided he wanted me to know what it would feel like to be inside the music. So when I was quite small, he snuck me onto the stage at Lincoln Center during a performance and didn't ask because he knew they'd say no. And, you know, I have a really problematic relationship with my dad. And unfortunately, we don't have much of a relationship anymore. And we certainly don't meld on music. But I do feel like he gave me a great gift in that moment. in that I did understand sort of like the swelling of the sound and the floorboards and the resonating around you and the community of making something together. And I feel like that stayed with me. He gave me that sort of gift, really, you know. And other things about, like, you know, there was a lot of depression in my family, including my mom. So I really did, I saw what it was like to feel stuck. And that life always scared me quite a lot. So I kind of ran like my ass was on fire away from it. And that's, I think, part of my commitment to continuing to challenge myself in my smallness or my limitations, continuing to question what could life be. And also that punk, you know, those punks, like those bands, those musicians, they do give you the sense that like life really is for grabbing, you know, like there's no two ways about it. It's going to be gone. And in the meantime, it's an exciting prospect to grab for a meaningful life. Do you know? So some hodgepodge of all those things, including the fact that I didn't happen to be a person that was going to ever do drugs and that I didn't end up down that road, which ruined lives for several wonderful people that I knew. Not all of them, but, you know, I was fortunate that wasn't my road. Yeah, some hodgepodge of those things, plus a type A personality, which they're proving that's not a real thing, but all right.
Well, the thing about believing or not believing there's a thing called a type A personality, or believing or not believing there's a thing called Gen X or Gen Z or millennial, it doesn't matter whether it's an accurate description. It can be a formative description. It can make something real that wasn't there before. Anyway, Ali, I'd love to ask you whether there are things you might wish to add to what we've discussed.
Well, I mean, I was trying to think about that on the fly. And I mean, you've written a ton of books and some all this stuff about greenwashing, which is so exciting to me because that's a really compelling, frustrating issue for me. I mean, what do you think about a creative life? Like, are you committed to, in what ways have you committed yourself? And, you know, like.
Well, of course, like you, I have no Freudian story to tell about my father whatsoever.
Freud who?
Yeah, right. Which one? There were a few of those, right? There was an Anna Freud, I think. And
I'll go with her. Yeah.
Yeah, let's go with Anna.
Yeah.
So, I think I wanted to find a way of expressing myself, probably. And I tried fiction, and I wasn't very good at it, though I do have a fantastic idea for a film that is going to make somebody $1 million who can write things like dialogue and story. Just a couple of things that I can't do, but hey, you know, I'm close. So.
Is it us that we're going to make $1 million? Just you can tell me.
I
now.
Think
is it us?
It could be you. In fact, I'm very happy once we stop recording to tell you the story because it takes
okay.
about. It is not even an elevator pitch. It's more opening the fridge door and closing the fridge door without taking anything out or putting anything in pitch.
Hot, love it. Go ahead.
So,
yeah,
money could be coming your way very rapidly following this podcast.
It sounds like a pyramid scheme, but all right, go ahead.
Well, that's true.
Or a TED Talk.
Oh, yeah. I hope it's more of a pyramid scheme than a TED Talk. But anyway, I think I was very committed to wanting to express myself. I wanted to find a way to change my life and get out of the rut I was in. One of several that I've been in. And now it is more related to survival in the way you were describing about paying the rent and whatnot. So I haven't had a proper job for 5 years. I've lived in five countries in 5 years.
Wow.
I'm currently undocumented where I am. And
don't ask.
No, it's fine. I'm in Spain and this is where I work. I'm actually a public employee while being illegal.
Wow. This is all very exciting. Is this the movie? <You can tell.
laughs> No, the movie is much more exciting than this. The movie is sex, feminism, Mexico. It's much more
Ooh.
interesting than living on your own in Madrid with a cat that needs a pedicure, right?
Carry
So
on. Yes.
right now, some of the writing is about, if I don't keep writing because of my age, no one will give me a job. I've got to be available to go anywhere at any time. Tonight at 6 o'clock, I've got a sort of job interview in another country. So you're used to being very precarious in employment, as is your husband. It's something that I was very used to in my 20s and through to my late 30s, really. But I stopped being used to from my late 30s to my late 50s. And now it's real for me and scary. So all those things about, healthcare and whatnot, right? Anyway, sorry for the long answer, but thank you for your question. But of course, and this really is the finished to the answer.
Oh, hold on 1 second, sorry. I'm still on. Sorry, good.
Be done in 2 minutes.
No,
The
that's all right.
last thing is just to say that, of course, the topics I write about are about political commitments and always have been and always will be.
Good for you, man. Good for you. Yeah. Well,
Thank you.
the last thing I'll say is, speaking of Freud, my friend likes to say that whole penis envy thing. She's like, it's another P word, another P word. Power. Power. It's the only context. It is interesting when you go back, you're like, he's like, oh, it must be my penis that are, it's like, oh God, you're missing the point. So circling back to my book, The Ballad of Speedball Baby, there's a lot of not power envy, there's power grabbing. How about
Like it,
that?
like it. Thank you so much, Ali.
Thank you so much, Toby. That was lovely.